Coming up today, Brexit hacks, high-tech barbecues, Russia's Google, and what you can learn from looking at a lot of penguin poop. You're listening to episode 313 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me today are a rejuvenated Matt Burgess.
Hello.
Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
And Jeremy White.
Hello.
Welcome back, Matt. Feeling better?
I am, actually. Thank you very much for asking.
Well recovered.
Very considerate. I heard you all talking about me on the podcast last week when I wasn't here.
He listens even when he isn't here.
That's dedication.
He doesn't look better, does he? He still looks a bit peaky.
Little bit. And we're in a very small room, so we'll all be a bit peaky. Matt, you can go first with your disease-related fact.
Yeah, it's actually very... Well, you've pretty much spoiled it already.
Sorry.
But the varicella zoster virus is... dormant in your body throughout your life once you've had chickenpox, and when your immune system gets broken, you can get shingles. That's something that I learned last week in a painful and scabby manner.
There you go. So now you know the disease that Matt Burgess had. Shingles. Roland, what's your fact?
Okay. Well, I learned... Actually, this is another guessing fact, because I know you love them, James.
Oh, please.
So, in the US, of the top 9 apps, 8 are owned by either Google or Facebook. What is the 9th?
Shazam.
No.
Skype.
No.
Amazon Shopping.
No, and I will give you a clue. Say it's not owned by another massive company.
Oh.
Is it a game?
No. I know, I was surprised.
Dead Radio, as they call it, or Dead Air is not fun. So go on, tell us.
It's Pandora Radio.
Huh.
Yeah,
that's actually not that surprising.
Makes sense.
And they're just about to pimp their service as well.
Oh, to who? Oh, do you mean pimp as in make better or sell?
Yeah, pimp in the
where Roland's mind
sense.
Directly goes to.
There we go. Jeremy, what did you learn this week?
I learned this week that much like the individuality of everyone's fingerprints applies to your tongue as well. Everybody's tongue.
I'm so glad you said
is
tongue.
Different. Okay. Everybody's tongue is different. So that's my sort of standard fact. This is my fact that I absolutely love, which I learned this week.
Is it about cream eggs?
Because it's not about cream eggs.
Hang on, because I feel like a week ago you promised you would be making a cream egg,
and we promised we wouldn't bring it up.
I was, yeah,
because he hasn't.
Yeah.
Oh, what?
What? I must admit, I forgot to bring it in. I actually have some pictures I'll show you later after the podcast.
Yeah.
He said, hastily getting off subject. No, my fact is actually this. If you take a toilet paper roll and you lay it out, so the average toilet roll is 400 sheets in length. So lay it out flat. Now, to get some perspective on evolution... Dinosaurs came into being on the 19th sheet from the end. Oh, so 400 sheets, just 19th sheet from the end, dinosaurs came into being. They became extinct the 5th sheet from the end, and around, so they were around for just 14 sheets, if you like. Now, then mammals came into being after that, and then our species, Homo sapiens, only came into being in the last millimetre of the last sheet. So just the last 200,000 years.
Something to think about if you're listening to the podcast on the toilet. I learned somewhat more prosaically that 12.8% of car accidents in Japan involve drivers over the age of 75. Japan is well known for having quite an aging population. So one of the solutions to this is elderly people in Japan are being encouraged to give up driving and to give up their driving licenses for food coupons.
What?
Yeah. Hungry? Maybe don't drive. Strange approach. Our first story this week is, I'm sorry, about Brexit, but it's not about the politics of it, just as it never is on this podcast, hopefully. It's about something that's got a bit of a wired angle to it. So this week, two headlines from the BBC and The Guardian. Brexit vote site may have been hacked, MPs say in report, and Brexit foreign states may have interfered in vote, report says. So you'd think, oh, well, it sounds like... someone has hacked the Brexit vote.
Which it wouldn't be completely unrealistic given the hacking that's gone on in the US around the DNC and the elections and the allegations that have been made there. But that's yes. not exactly the case here, is it?
No. So a House of Commons Public Accounts and Constitutional Affairs Select Committee has published a report looking into last summer's EU referendum. This will always happen after a big vote. Some parliamentary committee sits down and goes, OK, and that's what happened. So this isn't a report on the outcome of the vote, but rather how it was carried out. So everything was done in a fair, proper and legal way. One particular area of concern was the online voter registration system, which went down for a few hours on the last few hours of voting on before the voter registration deadline on June 7th. The government was forced to introduce emergency legislation so that people could vote to an extended deadline, but there were concerns that, for one, people that went to try and vote as the deadline was approaching and found the site down may not have come back to vote later, but also that people who had thought, nah, can't be asked, might then have gone, oh, extra deadline, I can, and did. So that in some way, it changed the result a little bit, but probably not. Now. Yeah, so it's something that doesn't necessarily have an impact on the overall vote, but that isn't necessarily what's of concern. What's of concern is how safe are these kind of systems from attack?
So the report actually concluded by saying that it could not rule out the possibility that the crash in the system may have been caused by a DDoS, distributed denial of service attack, using botnets.
Which,
for those who aren't familiar with DDoS attacks, are basically when a website or a computer system is, and a server in many cases, is overwhelmed with requests to access a web page. So if 4 million people all at once decided to go to wired.co.uk, the website would probably crash because the servers aren't used to that amount of traffic.
Oh, yes, it wasn't. Yes, we are.
yeah, totally. So one potential reason for a DDoS attack, according to the committee, is potentially politics. So the committee notes that foreign powers such as Russia and China, quote, use a cognitive approach based on understanding of mass psychology and of how to exploit individuals. And so what's happened here is a report has been put out and certain media outlets have added two and two together. They've seen that there's some speculation, some kind of discussions around the idea of a potential DDoS attack. And then they've read down the report and seen the words Russia and China, and they've written headlines like Brexit vote sites may have been hacked, MPs report, or foreign states may have interfered in Brexit vote.
And the big thing about this is there is actually no direct suggestion that a foreign involvement has actually happened in here. And I think it's very important to note about DDoS attacks that anybody can really do them. You can go online and you can pretty much buy a DDoS attack if you want. And there's easily guides you can set up and find out how to do this. So yes, while governments may be able to do this and do this in occasions and have been linked to do it, if you really wanted to, you could go out and try and launch one of these on your own. It's not a highly sophisticated cyber attack.
Yes, and in fact, the committee
or campaign of fake news either. Really, I mean, like it's.
Well, this is the other interesting thing, isn't it? So it's a very kind of boring report. It makes some fairly prosaic observations about the system, but doesn't really come to any conclusions. It's just sort of a general wondering about things that happened around the vote and things that might be important to consider. Nowhere does it draw any conclusions around this, but two very, very prominent news organizations have gone out and put up a story which would lead people to believe, yeah, particularly with what's happening in the United States, that this is the case here, and it isn't. So nowhere, absolutely nowhere in this report does it say that there is any evidence that a foreign power meddled in the Brexit vote, the voter registration process, or anything. In fact, the committee report notes that there's no direct evidence. It's a really, really bizarre story. So an acquaintance of mine, David Gilbert, who writes for Vice News, pointed out he asked a spokesperson for the group that put together this report what was going on. And the spokesperson said that the crash had indications of being a DDoS attack, but then referred them to another report prepared by software consultants at a company called Equal Experts. That pointed to yet another report from the group that operated the website, saying a report from the FCO services highlighted that no DDoS attack was ongoing at the time of the incident. So it's a report referring to a report referring to a report that says that there's no indication that a distributed denial of services attack occurred. So what we have here is a non-story
story, yeah.
that a lot of people will read. The reason we decided to bring it onto the podcast is that when I was browsing through The Guardian early today, it was the most read story on the site. So this is obviously something that's really appealing to certain people's political persuasions, and incorrectly so.
Fake news.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the legs it has, actually, with that in mind.
Yeah, so separately, the government's own report into the website failure, which was published in late 2016, concluded that the site went down because it couldn't cope with a sudden surge in visitors as the registration deadline approached. And you could say a DDoS attack, which is a sudden surge in traffic, would be an awful lot like a load of people going to register to vote. And the final thing on this, before we move on, it should be said that, yes, China or Russia could do this sort of thing, might be doing this sort of thing, but equally a 14-year-old kid in their bedroom in Slough could do this kind of thing. If a foreign power really, really wanted to get under the skin of another country's democratic process, they do something a lot more smart than a DDoS attack against a voter registration service. So we'll leave it at that. Don't necessarily believe all the news you read, and don't necessarily believe it just because it's on a news site that you'd usually trust. Our second story this week, Jeremy, it's a little bit sunny outside. An awful lot of people are going to be preparing for the Easter break. Whether you're of faith or not, you still get a few days off.
That's right.
People will be maybe having a few beers, maybe jugs of Pimm's will be flowing, and the barbecue will be out, right?
Exactly. Let's move on from Brexit and move on to the far more important topic of barbecues.
Yes.
Because it's a British pastime, as we all know, and we have to have good barbecues.
When I was a student, we used
an upturned metal dustbin lid on bricks as a barbecue.
And that luxury, you had bricks?
Luxury, yeah. Bricks, yeah. And we used to set light to it on a tar roof as well, which, thinking back on it, that's not quite the right thing to do. So, looking to produce the ultimate barbecue, as he does in every category he gets into, Heston Blumenthal has got together with an Australian barbecue manufacturer, Shriro. That's difficult to say, Shriro, and to produce the Everdure range of barbecues. Now, these barbecues are good looking, I have to say. I actually do quite fancy them. They're really bloody nice. Now, the thing is, these barbecues, is that they go from the sort of Mack truck of barbecues, the massive hub, which is the top of the range, and all the way down to a tiny little cute little cube barbecue, which you can just have, again, on some bricks, maybe, on a flat tar roof.
And they're gas and they're charcoal, and they range in price from about 150 quid way up to, I think, around
£1,200. £1,500, I think. Now, the point being is that this is the first time in the charcoal ones, the top three of the charcoal ones, they have, for the first time in barbecues, a hybrid electric and charcoal fire system. So the starting mechanism is done by an electric coil, much the same way you used to get on those old cookers. You used to have an electric coil in there, and you press a button. And of course, it means the barbecue has to be plugged in, but you press a button and it within 10 minutes you have coals hot enough to cook on. And it also, if you're not going to use it, it senses you're not using it, then it turns itself off and you can start it again just in 10 minutes time. Now, the point being with this is that it means, according to Heston, who we interviewed actually, and you can read the whole interview online and see a video too of the guys from the Fat Duck using the barbecue. Now, the whole point of this with Heston is that you don't have to use fire lighters and you don't have to use lighter fuel or anything like that. So no nasty chemicals on your charcoal that you then have to burn off before you can start cooking. And even then, there will always still be some sort of residual chemical trace, so Heston says anyway. So a much cleaner burn for your food, so the food tastes as it should on a barbecue, and a much more convenient way to start it. But it doesn't stop there. No, you've got
Jeremy's eyes are alight.
I love it.
He's doing his Top Gear thing.
I absolutely love it. Yeah, no, basically, it's got this rotisserie. The rotisserie is built into the hub, the top of the range one, so it's got these two steel tubes that come up out of the barbecue, of which you then can spit roast a pig if you really want to, just on your home barbecue. No extra equipment needed. It's all there for you. Now, That's worth, in my opinion, you know, way over a grand for a barbecue. This is the only barbecue you'll ever need. And so I would go for that one if I was tempted. But I bloody am.
After spending £1,500 on your new barbecue, you're then going to have to stretch extension cords out your house into your garden so that you can plug it in.
That's true.
That's the downside.
That is the downside. You do have to plug it in. But actually, these days, outdoor power sockets are quite commonplace.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not on every, you know, you do have to get them fitted properly, of course. You can't just, you know, shove a power outlet yourself on the outside of the building. That would be terribly dangerous. No, you have to get them done properly. But it has got a reasonably long a power cable, and of course you don't have to use the electric lighting system if you don't want to. You can either go for a lower model, which is just one of the charcoal models, but also you can just not use the electric system. However, you can also go for one of the gas barbecues as well in the range. Heston said to us that he hated gas barbecues before because they almost boiled the food because the gas never got hot enough. So one of the major areas of development they used for the gas barbecue side was they had to create much, much hotter gas burners, so it went up to heat much, much quicker and didn't go much slower like normal gas barbecues do. So you can actually sear food in this proper gas barbecue. Also, they had to custom make the knobs on the barbecue, the gas valve knobs on the barbecue, so you had smaller gradations of the, so the flame, you could control the flame a lot more than on previous gas barbecues.
So the two settings aren't not cook and burn.
That's right, yeah, like gas mark 1 to gas mark 10 and that's it. You know, basically, it was, you have the more control over it. So it was actually a decent stab at trying to make these sorts of things better. But actually, if you go online and look at the site, look at wired.co.uk and go to the story, the barbecues themselves are really nicely industrially designed. And, you know, this is probably more down to Shriro in Australia. I mean, you know, the Australians know their bloody barbecue, for Christ's sake. And if they didn't, we'd be in terrible trouble. I lived there for 2 years and, you know, it was like getting a masterclass in how to do a barbecue. They've got them bloody everywhere. In street corners, you can just put coins in, there's barbecues there. Anyway, so...
That's not true.
It's true. It's true. Okay, you go to the beach and they've got all barbecues. Yeah. At all parks, they've got barbecues, public barbecues. They've run lived in barbecue, exactly.
I have every night, except for the barbecue. Barbecues everywhere.
But they do. And also, not only that, he hasn't stopped there. If you know, he's basically also going to. So we said the standard question: okay, where's this going next? And he wasn't stumped. He's already working on plenty of ideas in how to actually increase, you know, the offering for these barbecues. And what I particularly like
is there going to
be an app, and there's going to be connected devices. Exactly. And there's going to be probes. You know, temperature probes in there, so you can get on your phone. It'll tell you exactly when your meat's done, and it will, some other things as well coming. What we'll have to do was, what was that thing? He said he wanted a frozen unit, like a freezer, like a cooler, like a big cooler bag, you know, where you could keep your meat in. I mean, where he wanted it to be a wooden top on it, that it would turn into a bench. So you could basically have this. Oh, and so you could, you know, you could keep your food frozen until you wanted to cook it. And then the tub you would keep the meat in would actually be something to sit on. And my favourite was a plug-in lighting system, not to light the coals, but to light up your barbecue so you can cook in the dark. Now, anybody who's ever tried barbecuing in the dark knows that it's bloody impossible.
You'd think they make a lot of light, but they don't.
But it's backlit, so everything you're cooking is in silhouette. So you go, is this cooked? I can't bloody see. And then you take the chicken off and it's burnt to a cinder. I nearly swore. It was burnt to a cinder. But basically, I think that's a genius idea for this thing. So I was very impressed.
So last week we learned that if you want to excite Jeremy quite a lot, giant cream eggs. If you want to send him off the scale, innovation in barbecue technology. Thank you very much. As Jeremy said, you can read about it and see a little video of how they all work on wired.co.uk. Our third story this week, to kind of keep with the serious, less serious. Well, no, barbecuing serious, sorry.
Yep,
but this is more serious. In Russia, Google isn't king. So a few months ago, I got to meet Arkady Volozh, who is the CEO of Yandex. And in Russia, if you want to look for something online, you don't Google it, you Yandex it. If you want to call a cab, you don't use Uber, you use Yandex. If you want to stream music, you don't use Spotify, you use Yandex Music. If you want to buy something, Amazon, no, Yandex. You can kind of get where I'm going here. So it's a huge technology company that, by Yandex's own admission, not many people outside of Russia have heard of. But that's slowly starting to change. It's a fascinating company, fascinating guy. So it commands 64% of all online search in Russia and claims 61% of all online advertising in Russia. So it's Google.
And Uber. And Amazon.
And Spotify.
This sounds like Line in Asia, you know, with their version of WhatsApp, where basically everyone does everything through Line. You can even get, for example, or WeChat, you know, you can even get a mortgage through WeChat.
Yeah, so it's this strange way of thinking that the way that we do things must be the way that the whole world does things.
Yeah.
And what Yandex has done out of Russia is started to now influence near Russian markets. So the former Soviet states, but also places like Turkey and Israel, it's starting to get more and more involved in. So it sort of sees its business model is it sees places where the big tech companies that we all have heard of are traditionally weak and tries and works out how it can steal some of the market. But of course, when you say technology companies in Russia, something that always comes to people's minds is, oh, you must be getting help from Vladimir Putin. And this was a story, Roland, you put me onto, and we were interested to try and get a sense of what's actually going on here, right?
Yeah, exactly, because I didn't know, but it seems from the outset like it would be impossible to get on in Russia without having some accommodation with the Russian state. And then if you're a big Russian tech company, and you're expanding, does that mean the Russian state is expanding alongside? So I was really interested to hear, well, when you put this question to him, how he responded, because, I mean, they have had difficulties just even cooperating with the state. I mean, because you had that example of the Pokemon Go story, right, where the location tracking suddenly turned off.
Yes, don't ruin people's Pokemon Go, or more seriously, people's GPS. So I think this was in 2016, October 2016, around Red Square. Anyone trying to play Pokemon Go or hail a cab or work out that they were at Red Square, although it would probably be quite obvious, would suddenly have been teleported out to the edge of the city near one of Moscow's airports, about 20 kilometers away. And this was seemingly because of some GPS jamming device that had been put inside the Kremlin. Yandex doesn't really know why, but it made it very difficult for the company to accurately fare people for the journeys that they'd taken using Yandex Taxi. So when I put this question to Arkady Volozh, the CEO of Yandex, he said, "I don't have friction with the state, just like I don't have friction with the weather. What happens if it's raining? I need to build a service to avoid the rain," which is quite an eloquent way of putting it.
It's diplomatic. Yeah.
He's very diplomatic. And he's quite.
But what does it mean?
Yeah, so he's quite unusual for a technology CEO, certainly of a company with this valuation. It was when it went on the New York Stock Exchange, it was the largest IPO since Google. He laughs a lot as a person, and he's very forthright. So as with a lot of these interviews, you have someone from the PR or communications team sitting in the room with you, and it's their job to put their hand up or just to stop things when you start to ask questions that they would rather you don't ask, which can be very annoying. In this instance, I asked a question that the comms person didn't like, and she started interrupting, and he just kept talking, and then she kind of got more alarmed with his answer, and he kept talking and kind of went, no, it's fine. It's fine, I'm going to answer this. So you end up actually getting to know the guy a bit better, and he speaks his mind a bit more, which is refreshing, certainly.
So, but to get back to the question then.
Yes.
So when he says, oh, you know, I just put up an umbrella if it's raining, what's the umbrella? If the rain is Vladimir Putin, what is Yandex doing to accommodate itself to this authoritarian state?
So it's getting out of the rain, Roland. It's getting out of the rain. So the umbrella analogy probably isn't that useful. What you might like to think of is I get in a plane. So if you're living somewhere where it happens to rain a lot, you might just go to somewhere where it's a bit sunnier. So in recent years, Yandex has started setting up offices all over the world. It's got sales offices and local representations across Europe and in developing markets. So it's very much that, yes, it's a Russian company. Yes, a huge amount of its business is in Russia, but expansions into places like Turkey and potentially the European Union, which was another topic that we touched on, if it feels that it can compete in other countries, it's going to move to them, because the volatility in the Russian market means that you can't really rely on it.
And it's sort of one Russia anyway, if it has this massive market share.
Yeah. Yes.
How much of its resource does it need to keep ploughing into there? Surely it's going to keep it, and then it might as well focus on other markets as well.
You'd imagine if it stopped paying attention to Russia that the Russian state might have something to say about it. So in November 2016, LinkedIn was blocked in Russia for failing to comply with local data storage laws. So the argument was that this is to the benefit of Yandex. Yandex's response to that, Volozh said that it's not his agenda, it's not his fault. But it's hard to be an international company in the world at the moment, and that local laws and sanctions tend to impinge upon companies' ability to do business in places, which is particularly interesting with the EU referendum vote and the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah, it must be hard.
Yeah, those poor international businesses.
but also, I get it's tough for him, and I get that maybe he didn't have a choice, but it's very hard to see how Yandex isn't collaborating in some way with the Russian state, and obviously it's really, really hard to find these things out. It reminds me of a piece I did about ages ago. Do you remember this one about the mapping company in China, like one of the biggest mapping companies, mm-hmm. Baidu Maps?
Yeah.
And it turned out they'd wiped all these different little bits off their version of Google Street View.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't really work out what they'd done, but it seemed to be a lot of power plants. Why? We didn't really know.
No one needs to see power plants, Roland.
Well, because power plants... Yeah, so this was the theory that I spun up in my head, that power plants might indicate pollution, and therefore you might want to get rid of them on Google Street Maps to vanish them. I mean, that's the sort of thing that's going on with these companies and in these countries.
Or that you might not want people outside the country doing reconnaissance on power plants by having instant street-level photography of critical infrastructure.
Exactly. Who knows? Yeah. Because what was weird is that it was so badly done.
Mm-hmm. But Google does it too.
Yeah, so Google kind of blurs out sites of kind of, I guess, like national security interest.
Yeah.
But I guess the difference is that with Google, there is a process, albeit a kind of fairly opaque one. With Yandex, there's... and Baidu, there's no process at all. It's impossible to find out. And the alliance with the state is that much closer.
Yes, and it will be increasingly interesting the way that they're perceived once people in Europe, or if people in Europe, become aware of Yandex. So if, as we were talking about on the podcast last week, I think it was, if Margaret Vestager's ruling against Google does open up the market more and is harsh on, well, not harsh on Google, but comes down quite hard on Google, then it might be companies like Yandex that stand to benefit. And this was another question that I put to Arkady, was that, well, what would happen? He said, if there was a fair and level playing field, we would come. Of course, the question to follow up on that is, well, there's not a fair and level playing field in Russia. Companies like LinkedIn are being blocked. His response would be, if it rains, build an umbrella.
Yeah, but his personal history with Google is really interesting, isn't it? I know you spoke to him quite a lot about that, and his meetings with Sergey Brin going back over the years.
Yeah, so... they were founded a year before Google in Moscow in 1997. And he refers to a couple of instances where Sergey Brin came to Moscow around the early days of Google. So this would have been 1997, 1998, maybe early 2000s. And then a little later, just before Google was about to go big with Android. And so you can kind of see these two companies doing a bit of a sort of dance in the night. They're coming close to each other. They're getting interested in kind of doing business together, but maybe then they're separating away. And now they're very, very separate. And I can't imagine they have an awful lot to do with each other. But it was interesting that at these very, very formative moments for Yandex and Google, and crucial moments for technology, that Sergey Brin was in Moscow, and that Arkady Volchok can remember spending time with him. Sort of an interesting little coming together.
Yeah, because you've got that story about Sergey playing... Was it that he's playing with a smartphone?
Yeah, he was playing with a smartphone a few months before Android started to take over the world. And if only companies had have known what Google was planning, because Android went from being pretty much nothing to being a piece of software that billions of people around the world use.
Even in Russia?
Yeah. Yeah, and this is a big problem for everyone, that Google has been able to very successfully use Android to really, really up its market share around the world. And that is obviously something that the European Commissioner, Margaret Vestager, is looking into. So there's all sorts of interesting kind of links between this and the case going on.
One of the most interesting links you've mentioned in this story, I have to say, for me, is the Kremlin's ability to block people playing Pokemon Go.
I know, right?
Which I would absolutely love to be implemented further around the world. But, you know, so put GPS, I'd like to know how they're doing that. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think you just need to buy a little black box that sits in a corner somewhere blinking malevolently. We'll leave it at that.
We call us Jeremy.
Oh, yeah. God, exactly. All those weeping Pokemon Go players just crying in the corner. What a terrible shame.
They should be barbecuing, Jeremy.
Absolutely. They should be bloody barbecuing.
Should be barbecued. Barbecue the Pokemon.
You can read my interview with Yandex's CEO, Arkady Volosh, in the latest edition of Wired magazine. It will be online in the next few days. Our final story this week is, again, another departure. It's a funny word, but not a funny topic. Poop, Matt Burgess. Penguin poop.
Yeah, so from the really highly delicate...
This is going to be our shit story, isn't it? Actually, this is the shit story.
This is very serious journalism, Jeremy.
It started...
So, this week, while James has been reporting on the delicate balance between the Russian government and giant technology companies, I've been reporting on penguin poo. Have any of you ever been to Ardley Island or even heard of Ardley Island?
Is it crap?
Hey!
Oh, it's going to carry on.
Decorum,
carry on,
please.
No, I didn't think you would have. But it's because the island is in... part of the South Shetland Islands in Antarctica, and it is almost completely inhabited by penguins. There are 5,000 pairs of gentoo, which is a species of penguins, that are mating pairs. So it's one of the biggest penguin breeding grounds in the world. And penguins have lived there for about 7,500, 8,000 years this week. And it's a tiny little island that's little more than a mile long. You basically can't move for falling over penguins. And
which is why no one really goes there apart from people doing research into penguins.
Yes. And some of those researchers that have been there recently are from the British Antarctic Survey, or Arctic Survey even, sorry. And they have basically been looking at penguin poo.
So it turns out that when you've got thousands of penguins on a very small speck of land, that obviously they poop a lot, and that poop builds up, and that poop can tell us something.
It can. So the poop is actually called guano, which is excrement from birds and penguins and the like. And the penguins on this island produce around 84.5 grams per day of guano each, which is around 139 tons throughout the breeding season, which is a lot of poop. And this has been going on for as long as penguins have obviously lived there and eating fish and everything like that. So the penguin excrement, to bring this up a level,
the poo mountain,
has actually been sliding into Ardley Lake. So
Jeremy's gone.
So I've got a poo lake now.
I think that's pushing it a little bit far, but throughout the thousands of years that the penguins have been there, the deposits have been going into Ardley Lake, and the researchers from the British Antarctic Society have been pulling up sediment from the bottom of the lake from thousands of years ago. When they started to pull this sediment out, they actually found that it had a bit of a strange smell, which was, unsurprisingly, the... poop.
Wait a minute, they're getting paid. They're getting paid to go do this.
It's serious science.
But what it's allowed them to do is see major extinction events that affected these penguins, and you wouldn't be able to get this data without shoveling through miles and miles of poop.
Yeah, effectively. So from the sediments that they pulled out from the bottom of this lake, they can obviously date when the sediments was around and when it was from, and the percentage of poop in these sediment samples that they pulled up actually gives them an indication of how many penguins were there and basically what was going on the island. And they found that there was actually three major drops in poop and in penguins. And this is tied into when there were a series of volcanic eruptions from a nearby island. So basically the volcano erupted, loads of ash came down, killed loads of penguins, sort of layered them under layers of ash, a bit like a penguin Pompeii, I guess, in some respects, but there's no actual preserves.
Yeah, a poopay.
And
we're not allowed Jeremy on the podcast if we're going to be talking about anything to do with fecal matter.
So basically, to sum it up, they looked at the penguin poo, they looked at the geographical events, and what they concluded was that these penguins are nearly wiped out, and it took hundreds of years for the colonies to actually build themselves back up on this island. And really, just from analysing the remains that were left in the sediments from thousands of years ago, they were able to predict like what the development of penguins was in the region. And they say that using this method, they could also look at other penguin colonies around Antarctica and sort of work out what has happened to the colonies' sizes in the past, if they were bigger. And there's potential to also try and combine this with climate data. In this particular research, they said that the climate data that they've seen, there's no direct link between the dropping in the penguins and stuff like that. It was just the volcanoes that had a big impact.
But it helps to show the resilience of the penguin populations to major extinction events. So if there were to be a very rapid and radical change in temperature, say, then that might also cause them a problem if their nesting grounds had changed.
Yeah, it did. And this is all found out from the poo.
Are they doing any research into their sense of smell by any chance? Anything like that?
No, I don't think so. Not at the moment.
I think ornithological researchers that go to islands like this in the Arctic Ocean and other isolated places around the world do comment that they stink. They really, really do stink. I can't imagine penguins can smell very well because if they could, they'd probably find it a bit gross. Well, there we
have
it.
They're not just crap in the sea. They're right by, they're on a bloody island. Just go crap in the sea.
I think it's a bit rough down there, really. Yeah. It's quite difficult for them to get back onto the islands, as anyone that's seen some of the recent BBC shows will know. The poor little dying, bleeding penguins trying to get back onto their little islands.
It's too late now, isn't it? I mean, they've been doing it for 8,000 years. Yes, you think, oh well.
It's like students moving into a house that they haven't cleaned it up.
Old habits die hard.
There's no point tidying
the
house.
Yeah, exactly.
Because some folks shat in the toilet.
All right. Well, I think we all deserve a long weekend after that. Well, Matt Burgess, you definitely do after managing to keep it together while Jeremy was pointing and laughing at you for about 5 solid minutes. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks very much for all of your contributions. We will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.